This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks about his new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. The book will be available on April 4th.
We'll hear from Justin about his work over the past 30 years getting innocent people released from prison.
We'll also hear excerpts from a legal panel considering the possibilities that the Supreme Court might overrule Grutter v. Bollinger. That's the landmark 2003 affirmative action case. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
There is a common belief that if you are arrested, you're probably guilty because where there's smoke, there's fire. People assume that only the guilty confess to crimes, because why would an innocent person confess to a crime they didn't commit? And when a person pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury, that's the end of the matter in the minds of most people. In fact, many innocent people are arrested, especially people of color, due to racial profiling and other forms of discrimination by law enforcement. Implicit bias often infects the case as it moves through the criminal legal system, from the initial police stop to interrogation, arrest, charging, trial, and sentencing. This is particularly tragic when a person is charged with a capital crime for which the death penalty is imposed and that sentence is carried out. However, it is estimated that between 10,000 and 20,000 people are currently serving time in prison after being convicted of crimes they did not commit, largely due to prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct. Unfortunately, even when exonerated, the psychological and physical damage done is so extensive that many people are never able to fully recover from the trauma. In addition, when the wrongful conviction is solely the result of prosecutorial misconduct, those convicted have no legal resource to be compensated for the wrong done to them because of prosecutorial immunity. Criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks has spent decades working to free innocent people from prison. The founding director of the California Innocence Project, Brooks is the author of the provocative new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. In it, he discusses false identifications, junk science, lying snitches, and incompetent defense lawyers, which all too often lead to the imprisonment of innocent people. My co-host Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are fortunate today to speak with Justin Brooks about these injustices in the criminal legal system and how they can be remedied. Justin Brooks, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Since the 1990s, thousands of innocent people have been freed from prison. How many successes has the California Innocence Project had with exonerating the wrongfully convicted? How do you decide which cases to take? How do you fund your work? And how long does it generally take to exonerate an innocent person?
Those are a lot of good questions. So I've personally had the privilege of walking 36 of my clients out of prison, but this work has been replicated all around the country, and it's been really amazing to see other innocence organizations, defense attorneys, and sometimes even prosecutors who have played this role in exonerating innocent people, and the numbers keep going up every year. How do we decide which cases to take? That is actually the most difficult and most heartbreaking part of this work. When I started the California Innocence Project in 1999, I remember naively thinking to myself, how am I going to get cases? And the LA Times did an article about the opening of the project, and I started receiving boxes of mail, and that has not slowed down over the past two decades. So I have a team of law students, and I have 100 volunteer attorneys, and we receive thousands of letters a year. With every one of them, we look into the case. We send out questionnaires. We interview their trial lawyers. We read through their appellate briefs. And then twice a week, there's presentations in my office on the cases. And I sit there with the awful Caesar-like power of thumbs up or thumbs down of whether a case proceeds. And what's difficult about that is, in a lot of those cases, I know we may very well have an innocent person, and I just know from my experience it'll be impossible to reverse that kind of case, that we won't be able to develop the evidence we need to overcome the burden of proof, which we have once someone is convicted. And then your third question of how long does it take? Well, that largely depends on how much cooperation we get. The shortest exonerations I've had in my career that have been around a year have all involved prosecutors working together with us to get the exoneration. And the longest exoneration took me 27 years. I started the case when I was 29 years old, and I finished it a couple of months ago, and I am 57. So, yeah, it takes a long time usually.
There is now a national network of innocence projects throughout the country. Can you explain to our listeners the history of this movement?
Sure. Well, in 1998, there was a conference at Northwestern Law School where all these men came who had all been exonerated from death row. And it was a much more important event than we realized at the time, because there was a group of us who were there who got together and started talking about starting a network of innocence organizations. Barry Scheck was there from New York, and they had been working for several years in the Innocence Project in New York, and a few projects had started to crop up. So there was a project that started then in Chicago at Northwestern. There was one in Florida. There was one in Washington. There was the Arizona Justice Project. And I started the fifth project, it was either fifth or sixth, in California, in San Diego. And since then, this network has grown and grown and grown and really become a movement. And we now have 60-some projects in the United States. We have a network of projects in Latin America, in Europe, in Asia. And the reason it's really grown is because it's a universal problem that there are innocent people incarcerated all around the world, that there's no criminal legal system that doesn't get it wrong. And so it's really become a movement of freeing innocent people from prison.
Justin, what is the leading cause of wrongful convictions?
So that's kind of the whole exploration of my book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent, was I want to sit down and look at all the causes that I'd seen over the course of my career, and there are many. In sort of things like false testimony, it's hard to categorize as one thing, because there's false eyewitness testimony, there's false victim testimony, there's false expert testimony in science. But basically, the leading cause of wrongful conviction is evidence coming into court that's not accurate, that ultimately leads innocent people to go to prison.
The wrongful conviction and imprisonment of innocent people is not the only problem with the criminal legal system. The constitutional right to a fair trial is routinely violated, even in cases where there may not be evidence of factual innocence. How does this impact the work you do?
Yeah, so when I started doing this work, I did feel from my buddies in public defense and my criminal defense attorneys of this sort of feeling of, well, you know, you're representing innocent people, but it's important that everybody get a fair trial. And I firmly believe that. I mean, I started my career as a criminal defense attorney, and most of my clients had committed the crimes, and occasionally I'd have innocent clients. But it's important that everybody gets a fair trial. And I think what the innocent movement has done is it's put a mirror on the criminal legal system in a way that wasn't happening. Because the problem is the general public only really cares when it is an innocent person. So, you know, those of us who are lawyers, we care about a system being fair and just, regardless of whether someone committed a crime or didn't commit a crime. They're entitled to a fair trial. They're entitled to have the evidence tested. But the problem was that the general public didn't care as much about that. And I think what we've accomplished through the innocence movement, or continuing to accomplish, is improving the criminal justice system for everybody, because now you have more people caring about it, more people engaged in it. You have more of a spotlight on it through the media and through television and movies and documentaries and conversations like the one we're having here today. So I think we've been an important partner in general in improving the entire system.
As a retired criminal defense attorney, I appreciate that very much, Justin. In recent years, there have been significant studies that have exposed the inaccuracies of eyewitness identification. And in fact, it's now been established that nearly 70% of all wrongful convictions in this country have resulted from inaccurate eyewitness identifications. How can the system be changed to minimize the incidence of false identifications?
Yeah, the numbers, when we look at the statistics and the numbers of people who've been wrongfully convicted due to bad identifications, the numbers are just shocking. And as you say, perhaps 70% of all wrongful convictions have resulted from inaccurate eyewitness identification. And I think there's a simple answer to that, and there's a very complex answer. Now, the simple answer is there's a real disconnect between the actual quality of an identification in a courtroom and the weight that jurors give it. Because when someone walks in a courtroom and says, I'm 100% sure that's the person who committed the crime, most of the time the jury's going to convict. And they don't understand how that person got to that point of making that identification. They don't understand necessarily that maybe when the lineup was done or the photo array was done, the person wasn't that confident, and their confidence built up before the time they got to court. The evidence ultimately is what the jury hears, but the basis for it is often not that good. And the other thing is we're just not that good at seeing people and remembering them. I'll say to jurors and to groups of people I present to, I'll say, you know, have you ever been in a restaurant and you ordered one type of soup and you're looking right at the wait staff, there's bright lights, there's no gun in your face, and a few minutes later you change your mind and you can't remember who the person was. And that's just a few minutes later. Sometimes these identifications are done hours, days, weeks, months, and I've even seen cases of years later. And yet by the time that person shows up in court, they're very confident in the identification. So what can we do about this? Well, the first thing is to educate people about the quality of these identifications, that they're often not that good. And the second thing is to change our procedures. And in California, we've been battling that for 20 years. And finally, this past year, we got identification reform done throughout the state. And it starts with we've got to change the procedures for lineups. We know now that photo array lineups do not work and that you have to show people photos one at a time, or the comparison of looking at them together can distort what they remember. But the most important thing we need to do in these reforms is not allow police officers to be involved when they know who the suspect is, because they're not good poker players and they often give tells. And even sometimes when they do the process really well, and the witness will say, well, it looks a lot like number three, they'll say, okay, good job. And now that confirms in their mind that now the witness will go from it kind of looks like number three to when they're in court saying, I'm 100% sure it's that person. So there are many, many problems with identifications. I spend a chapter in my book talking about it. When I teach it in my wrongful conviction course, I spend hours talking about all the problems with it. And there are many, and you know, we don't have enough time to get into them all today, but one last one I'll just mention here is cross-racial identifications are the most shockingly bad identifications. And that's a tough thing to talk about, and I think lawyers are not necessarily comfortable always talking about race issues, and it really needs to be discussed that people have difficulty identifying people not of their own race. And it's just, it's not about racism, it's about exposure, particularly at a young age. And if your mom's white, your dad's white, your brothers and sisters are white, most of your community is white, you don't develop the kind of facial recognition software as a child that makes it easy to identify people of other races. And that the whole world suffers from that. But it's that kind of education that we need to do.
Thanks so much, Justin. Having represented several clients who've been the victims of these types of inaccurate eyewitness identifications, I so appreciate the work that you're doing. Another serious cause of wrongful convictions is coerced confessions. Again, I represent several clients who have been the victims of that as well, some as young as 14 years old at the time they confessed to serious crimes. How frequently do these false confessions arise, and from what common police practices? How can the system be reformed, if at all, to minimize coercive police interrogations resulting in false confessions?
Record. I mean, it's just so crazy the amount of battles that have been fought about recording interrogations. And we still even sometimes hear the police saying they don't have the resources to do it when every person on the planet is carrying around a recording device in their pocket. But that we do not yet have a national consensus that requires the recording of police interrogations. And that's been something that we've been fighting state by state, county by county, across the United States. It's a battle around the world. And I just think it comes down to fundamentally, jurors should be able to see exactly how that statement came about in order to assess the weight to give that evidence. Because if all they have is the final statement given after 12, 13, 14 hours of interrogation, they're not giving the appropriate amount of weight to that statement. And what we find in our work is that after many hours of interrogation, people just get fed up. Sometimes they're broken down, sometimes they're confused, but a lot of times they're just angry. And they just say, okay, you know, give me the paper, I'll sign it. And they're thinking, what difference does it make? I didn't do anything, and they're not going to be able to convict me. But now maybe they get a bad identification. Maybe they confirm that up with a snitch. And now the person goes to prison. So the remedy is very simple. We need to record all interrogations. We need to record basically all interactions between the police and the people that are being charged. And then we can assess the situation. And if they're, you know, questioned and it's appropriately done and the person gives a confession, then why wouldn't the government want the jury to see that? Because now you're seeing firsthand them making the statement. But this has been a battle that has been one of the most depressing battles on the front of wrongful convictions, because the remedies are very simple. They're not that complex. And yet it hasn't been done. And it's been a battle around the country. What's really behind all of this? It's behind being concerned about liability for misconduct and losing a case because the jury actually sees the whole picture. It's just part of the competitive enterprise of our criminal legal system that is problematic, that when things become competitive, then it's just trying to get the best evidence to get a conviction, not have all the evidence presented to the jury.
We're speaking with Justin Brooks, founding director of the California Innocence Project, about his new book, You Might Go to Prison, Even Though You're Innocent. Justin, jurors frequently expect to see scientific evidence, including DNA, fingerprint evidence, and ballistic evidence. Does every case involve one or more of these types of evidence? And how does expert testimony both contribute to and protect from wrongful convictions?
So DNA changed everything. DNA, before we could present DNA evidence in these cases, there was so much cynicism around the idea that anybody was innocent in prison. You know, there were people like Reuben Hurricane Carter, who was a hero to many of us, as a guy who was wrongfully convicted on basically no evidence except racism. But his case was one where there wasn't that kind of hard scientific evidence. So people could say, well, I still think he's guilty. And DNA came along and changed all of it. And so since 1993, in the state of California, I've been using DNA in the trial courts. And when I started the project, I knew that a lot of the DNA cases had already been gone through by 1999, and there was going to be a short shelf life on how many cases really did involve DNA, because of course, DNA only becomes really significant in typically rape and murder cases. Now, that's proven not to be true, because as we've gone along over the last 20 years, we've seen advances in DNA where we can use mitochondrial DNA in robbery cases if you have hair samples and things like that. But the reality is today that it's a very small number of our cases that involve DNA, but DNA opened the door to judges granting petitions, granting hearings, opened the door to the media attention on innocence, and it just changed everything. So certainly every case does not involve DNA, but many, many of our cases involve other types of forensic sciences that have been both developing and improving. And we've also been disproving sciences that in the past we put far too much weight on. For example, bite mark testimony, to me, is one of the worst pieces of forensic evidence. Oftentimes, these are bored dentists with too much time on their hands who love CSI, because it is the flimsiest of forensic sciences. We've seen a lot of bad science in the arson area. We've seen a lot of bad science in shaken baby cases. So I think what our movement has done is both build up strong sciences like DNA and utilize them more and more, but also we've been able to disprove other sciences, sometimes using DNA, where we come in and say, look, they might have said the bite mark matched, but the DNA clearly shows this isn't the person. And so it's been very, very interesting. In my office, each one of my lawyers is assigned a different forensic science to make sure we have an expert in the office on each one of them, and they go to the conferences and read all the journals and network with the experts, because it's absolutely critical that we have that capacity in order to undo some of these cases.
Justin, you write in your book that 54% of wrongful convictions involve some type of official police misconduct, such as the use of lying informants or snitches. Please explain some of the ways that police misconduct plays a major role in wrongful convictions. And, of course, we know that many convictions have been dismissed due to this police misconduct around the country. What is testa-lying, and why is it such a big problem?
Well, if you'd asked me this question 30 years ago, I probably would have had a different answer. But here's my answer as I approach my late 50s, in that I think most people get up every day and try to do the best they can. And I think that, you know, life is just a bell curve, that there's a small amount of people who are extraordinarily good at their work. Most of us fall into the good to okay. And then there's this percentage who are the terrible and the awful. And I think what happens with police misconduct is some of the police misconduct is just not being good at their job. Some of the police misconduct is trying to add evidence to cases where they really believe people are guilty and ignore evidence that could show innocence. And I think, and then some percentage of the cases are just absolutely awful people. And I think that's a small percentage, but it can have a huge impact. I mean, in California, we had the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles, where you literally had a unit of the Los Angeles Police Department acting as a gang and buying and selling drugs and planting weapons and doing outrageous behavior. And that does happen. That happens all over the country. You have those types of outrageous cases. But I think the thing that's more problematic is the larger number where people think they're doing their job correctly and are just not. And those are the kind of the incompetence that we see within the system. And that can be improved more than you can improve people who are just out to do bad things. So it is very discouraging that in a country where, and I work all over Latin America, so I've been dealing with, you know, we've got more than 30 innocence organizations in Latin America that I work with, and the police misconduct in Mexico, for example, is shockingly bad. I think in the United States what happens is it's more the bell curve, and we need to focus on that, and we need to, police the police better than we do.
Justin, we've been so appreciative of your insights and your experience in this area. Can you tell our listeners how they can follow the work that you do and that other Innocence Projects around the country are doing?
Sure. Well, they can go to our website, which is CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org, and hopefully pick up my book, available on Amazon.com and everywhere else, and read more about the problem of wrongful conviction.
Well, thank you so much, Justin, for being with us, and we highly recommend your new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Last October, Law and Disorder aired a segment exploring the possibility that the Supreme Court might be poised to overrule Grutter v. Bollinger and gut affirmative action. That's the landmark 2003 case that held that the 14th Amendment allows public universities to consider race as a factor to assemble a diverse student body. Around the time of our interview, the National Lawyers Guild's New York City chapter and the Society of American Law Teachers, or SALT, held an educational panel exploring the two affirmative action cases that the Supreme Court will decide by June or July. As many await the High Court's decision, we're pleased to present excerpts from this panel. The speakers are Victor Good, former executive director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and professor emeritus at CUNY School of Law. Corinthia Carter is a board member of the NLGMYC Chapter Foundation and president of the Legal Services Staff Association of the UAW. Rounding out the panel is law professor Vinay Harpalani from the New Mexico School of Law and a member of SALT's Board of Governors. The panel was moderated by Olympia Duhart, co-president of SALT and a law professor at Nova Southeastern University College of Law. Let's take a listen.
Why weren't our courts and our bar, the general bar of Washington, more integrated? Why was there such an absence of people of color in the bar and on the bench? Well, the conclusion that the commission came up with was that various forms of discrimination, both institutional and private, over an extended period of time, had operated to forestall the aspirations of people from various communities of color in Washington. And what is significant here, it pointed to Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans, particularly Filipinos, and also Native Americans, all people of color in the state of Washington, who were vastly underrepresented both in the educational system and in the legal profession. And so the response from the state of Washington was to institute affirmative action at the state university and in particular its law school. Marco DeFunis applied, was rejected, filed a lawsuit alleging that people of color at the school had been admitted ahead of him, even though his test scores were higher than theirs. The case went to the Washington State Supreme Court. The State Supreme Court affirmed their affirmative action program, which was then appealed to the United States Supreme Court. Now, of course, during this period, it took almost 3 years for the case to get before the court. The law school agreed to let Mr. DeFunis attend school. So in the spring of 1973, when the case was about to be decided by the court instead decided that the case was moot because Mr. DeFunis was actually only a few weeks away from graduating. But the importance of this case and the importance of this case as joining these sort of competing and conflicting elements over affirmative action is that on one hand, it for the first time drew upon the mounting legal scholarship that expanded our ideas of how race functioned in society and how it operated in a myriad number of ways. And on the other hand, whether or not that new scholarship and that new understanding of how we saw race in society would be integrated into the court's understanding of the Equal Protection Clause and the 14th Amendment, and would in fact be constitutionalized by recognizing affirmative action as consistent with, and in fact, a form of equal protection that was mandated by the Constitution. Now, my time is up, so I'm going to defer to my panelists to sort of pick up. But as you can see from this story and these origins, there's much that we can see and learn from the political context of the judicial philosophies that have opposed affirmative action for the last 40 years and are about to come to a head in the next few
weeks. Thank you. Thank you so much for that primer, for bringing us all the way back from Bakke to the present. It's a very good lead-in to our next speaker. We're very fortunate to have Deborah Archer, who's the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's also a professor of clinical law, co-faculty director of the Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law, and co-director of the Arthur Garfield Hayes Civil Liberties Program at New York University. And Deborah will be talking specifically about the Students for Fair Admissions against Harvard University, North Carolina, particularly what's at stake for fairness and equality in higher education. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me to participate. It's great to be with everyone to talk about these important cases. And so I'm just going to try to supplement a little bit about the cases in addition to what Vinay said. As you can see, these cases are another bite at the apple to challenge the law as Vinay has described it. Edward Bloom, the anti-civil rights advocate behind Shelby County versus Holder, which gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and Fisher 1 and Fisher 2, formed SFFA and orchestrated these lawsuits. And although the plaintiffs in the Harvard case and the UNC case have the similar goal, there are really important differences that are worth highlighting. So I'll spend some time doing that. And I'll start with the Harvard case. So after losing Fisher, Edward Bloom said that he realized that he would need Asian plaintiffs in order to really challenge affirmative action. And that's what he did in Harvard. Harvard has a very layered, holistic, race-conscious admissions program. And race is just one of many, many factors that Harvard considers. And SFFA brought several claims against Harvard challenging their limited use of race. So the litigation alleges that Harvard discriminates against Asian applicants. As Vinay said, this claim is not about affirmative action, it is about negative action, alleging that Harvard intentionally discriminates against those Asian applicants. They also allege that Harvard engages in racial balancing, trying to hit particular percentages of students of color. They say that Harvard uses race as more than a plus factor, meaning that they're alleging that Harvard uses it as a defining factor. It is determinative in some of the cases. They also allege that Harvard failed to use or even consider using race-neutral alternatives. And then finally, they asked the court to overturn the four decades of settled law that Vinay talked about and hold that universities cannot consider race at all in the admissions process. Because Harvard is a private institution, the claims were brought under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which the district court made clear that meant that Harvard was subject to the same standards that the Equal Protection Clause imposes on state actors. So they had to meet that framework that Vinay laid out. SFFA also seeks a permanent injunction that would require Harvard to, quote, conduct all admissions in a manner that does not permit those engaged in the process to be aware of or learn the race or ethnicity of any applicant for admissions. And yes, that means exactly what you think it means, which is why one of the reasons why these cases are so dangerous to those of us who fight for equality and equity. In the district court, it was a win for Harvard in both defending its affirmative action program and defending against claims of intentional discrimination against Asian applicants. And then that decision was affirmed by the First Circuit. In Students for Fair Admission versus UNC Chapel Hill, which was filed the same day as the Harvard suit, SFFA is really focused on challenging UNC's top 10% plan, which is similar to the one at issue in the UT cases that Vinay described. They brought three claims in this case under the Equal Protection Clause and Title VI, and they're overall alleging that race is the defining feature in admissions of candidates of color at UNC. But their specific claims also include that race was more than a plus factor, again, that it was a defining feature for applicants of color. They allege that UNC failed to use and consider race-neutral alternatives that were available to them outside of the top 10% plan. And then again, they say the court should ban the use of race in admissions. The relief sought here is identical to that in the Harvard case, including that total prohibition of any use or awareness of race during the admissions process. And UNC's program was also upheld by the district court. Some of the key differences that I want to highlight in addition are, one, for most of UNC's history, that flagship university engaged in de jure discrimination. It excluded Black, Latinx, and Native American applicants by practice and by law. And that impact of that discrimination really does still linger on their campus. And as a public institution, UNC, as opposed to Harvard, really has an obligation to educate all of the state's citizens. And then unlike the Harvard case, there is no claim of intentional discrimination against Asian applicants in the UNC case. The plaintiffs in the UNC case are white, but they still argue that high achieving Asian applicants are hurt by the admissions program. Before the Supreme Court, I think SFA has really leaned into its argument that neither Grutter nor any acknowledgement at all of race are consistent with Brown versus Board of Education, and therefore Grutter has to be overruled, and the use or even awareness of race has to be outlawed. Race, as you all know, really continues to matter, and this push at colorblindness is really the antithesis of diversity. It exacerbates racial injustice by preventing all of us from grappling with the many ways that race shapes our lives, experiences, and access to opportunities. An insistence on colorblindness would really do damage in a world that is shaped by race. Both universities and the civil rights community that are supporting their ability to use race are vigorously defending the programs. They've made all of the standard arguments defending the use of diversity and race in admissions, but they're also pushing back more this time, I think, against the framework for evaluating these programs that began in Bakke and continues to really constrain us today. Civil rights advocates, I think, have been forced to argue not about the impact that it has on students of color, but on how it, we want to argue about how it helps all students in order to meet these, the framework, the legal framework. But focusing on diversity argument really does not adequately address or respond to the equality argument. It doesn't take into account the extraordinary structural discrimination that continues to impact students of color. And a lot of that structural discrimination was presented as evidence in these two cases. And this time around, the respondents and their amici are really doing their best to push back against that framework while still arguing within that framework. They're trying to move the discussion beyond diversity to address issues of discrimination, exclusion, and access. And in some of the briefs, they're even calling on us to re-examine the concept of merit, pushing back against the fact that affirmative action is described as a preference, but the systems that benefit white people are never described as preferences. Those are described as merit criteria. In response to the arguments, SFFA is falsely equating racial discrimination with the remedies for racial discrimination. They're claiming that race is meaningless and arbitrary. They say that Grutter led to what they've called a parade of terribles like anti-racism, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, programs to promote Black-owned restaurants are targeted by them, scholarships for students of color, graduation ceremonies that celebrate Black, Latinx, and other graduates of color. Just the acknowledgement that systemic racism has placed Black and Latinx people at heightened risks of illness and death. SFFA also dismisses wholeheartedly the educational benefits of diversity, and they claim that the research supporting it is pseudoscience. And they claim that, of course, as they have in the past, that race-conscious admissions stigmatizes and commodifies underrepresented students. And so there really is a lot at stake in the case. The lawfulness of affirmative action could be upheld, and both programs could be upheld. Or one of the programs could be upheld after the court applies the traditional framework. Some people think that may be the outcome because the court decided to separate the two cases. They were at first being heard as one, and now they're going to be heard separately. If affirmative action is struck down, the court could strike race-conscious admissions programs, or they could go further and mandate this colorblind admissions program that we talked about. And again, I just want to end by stressing that no matter what the court has said in previous cases, no matter what we hear, race continues to matter. It continues to constrain the life opportunities and life outcomes for some and expand the opportunities and outcomes for others. We continue to wrestle with inequality in our schools. Black, Latinx, Native American students remain underrepresented at top colleges. And our nation right now is in the midst of an ongoing and really significant backlash against the decades of work to move towards greater racial equity. And the fight against the systems and forces of white supremacy have combined with this underlying fear of what a racially just world looks like. And it's led to a wave of attacks across issue areas. And all of this, I think, is reflected in these two cases and the arguments that have been made. And I think we'll see that in the oral arguments on October 31st.
Okay, and our last speaker, we're so thrilled to host Corinthia Carter. She is the president of Legal Services Staff Association. It's basically a wall-to-wall union representing support staff, paralegals, receptionists, process servers, social workers and attorneys of Legal Services New York City. She's also a senior staff attorney at Legal Services for New York City on Court Street in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining us today, Corinthia. You're going to be talking about, I think, this, what's at stake for clients and importance of clients having lawyers who understand and represent their lived realities. Thank you.
Thank you, Olympia, and thank you for all the prior panelists. Yeah, so this one gets a little personal. So it's not just going to be based on, you know, the cases and the law. For me, I am a born and bred Brooklynite, and that's where I practiced as a housing attorney. And one of the benefits of, you know, because I am a Black woman, a person of color, and being in the court system and seeing how our clients are treated, because working in a nonprofit, you do kind of, you know, and they've done studies like the housing courts particularly are generally women of color, are the tenants that are facing eviction. So that's how like what representation is really important, because it gives me the opportunity to connect with my clients. And, you know, Blackness, like with any other, is not on a monolith. You know, we all don't have the same experiences, but there are things that we can relate to and that can help with our representation and connecting with clients who oftentimes are very guarded, and rightfully so, because, you know, we live in an anti-Black country, you know, as we see with these cases coming up. It's, you know, there is the issue of, you know, the race neutral, what they're saying, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, particularly as anti-Blackness, that's how I view a lot of it. My family's from Trinidad. That's another thing that also benefits me when I meet some clients from the islands who are unfamiliar with things. We can connect on my experiences being, you know, I go to Trinidad often. I have citizenship in Trinidad. So, you know, just kind of relating to them and kind of let them put their guards down. And I actually saw that first when I was an intern, and I interned in Brooklyn Legal Services. I started as an immigration intern and I did workers' rights. And I just saw how I could connect with our immigrant clients and make them comfortable. And, you know, particularly in representing people that in a nonprofit that deals with low-income communities, they're just not used to someone taking the time to talk to them, you know, someone they can relate to on certain issues and talk about things that's outside of their actual case, you know, and experiences that they've had. Even working at legal services through time, there's been a change in, you know, the number of Black attorneys and attorneys of color. But that was pretty much, and that's mostly because of the housing crisis in New York City and with the changes and right to counsel and things that kind of brought in this expansion and the need for them to hire more attorneys. And the newer attorneys tend to be people of color. And, you know, it helps with not just my representation of our clients, but also representation in the union. Because some of our staff has also been clients at one point and they got hired. So, you know, but it even assists in my representation of our members in our union, because they haven't had a person of color being president for 20 years. So, and a lot has changed in 20 years. But yeah, so, you know, I'm not going to take up a lot of time, because I do want us to have opportunities to go into Q&A, but, you know, the importance of representation, and we see this everywhere. I see when I speak to different students, you know, I participated in the New York Bar Association. I was part of they have this Diversity Pipelines initiative where we'd work with high school students interested in going to law, college students, as well as new law students of color, and trying to get them, you know, interested in doing this work, as well as, you know, whether they want to go corporate or nonprofit or whatever. But just having the opportunity to talk to these students and letting them know, first, you belong to any room that you step into. That's number one. You know, don't let them tell you otherwise. And secondly, it's important for those folks to see you. For my own health, I go to Black doctors. We see the trauma that's caused with, you know, in the medical field with Black women and women of color, you know, particularly Black women. That's where representation, it's necessary. It's not, do we need it? It's a must. Because again, you get an opportunity, people get to open up to you. Like you can talk about just different things and you just get comfortable in that space with that individual. And I try to holistically represent my clients. I don't see them as a number, you know, and I try to build a relationship with them in representing, because I think that just allows, you know, whatever the outcome of their case, they know that I was fully dedicated to representing them. Because I think you have to recognize people as individuals first. And even how I set up my office was just, I didn't have like my desk there and, you know, clients behind the desk. I always, a comfortable chair, we were at an angle. So I'm not behind the desk, but all of that mattered in my representation. I think that's part of how I was raised and who I am. And that's what I bring to my practice and anywhere, you know, how I deal with people. For being a housing attorney, when I was in law school, I actually represented myself in housing in a case that my landlord brought against me. And he actually had to give me $30,000 and return my apartment to rent stabilized status. And that as a housing attorney, that's one experience that I could, when I'm talking to clients that have rent overcharge issues, that's an experience that I've had. And because I was born and raised in Brooklyn, and I kind of, there's the rent stabilization laws, you know, which I only found, you know, I only became a tenant when I became an adult. When I moved out of my parents' house, that's when I became a tenant. So, you know, all of that I bring with me in my representation. And thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Corinthia. There were so many briefs filed by corporations who demand diversity in the courtroom. So I'm glad that you were also able to highlight the people, the clients who also expect diversity throughout the courtroom. Thank you. What probably will be a bleak legal landscape we're facing, you know, how can we, as advocates of inclusive excellence, think of unique solutions to make sure that lawyers reflect the communities they serve? What kind of unique ways can we address our efforts and commitment to making sure that this profession is inclusive and diverse?
Here's one thought. All of us, of course, are graduates of law school, and our law schools stay in touch with us. They seek contributions for scholarships and sometimes involvement in various committees at our law schools. We can go back to our law schools and ask them, what are they doing to prepare for inclusivity in the admissions process after these decisions take place? We didn't touch on it much, but I think that most of the panelists have a cautious pessimist approach toward what is about to happen at the Supreme Court level. That's certainly my perspective, that affirmative action, as it's currently judicially determined, is liable to come to an end with this court. That doesn't mean that diversity of enrollment needs to come to an end, but it means that our universities and our law schools need to be more creative in how they go about it.
Thank you. Any other panelists want to weigh in?
I'm happy to weigh in on that as well. First, on the last point that Victor mentioned about what's going to happen, I join him. I try to be optimistic until there's no room to not be. But even here, I don't hold out as much hope as I usually do. I think if the court was going to uphold affirmative action as it is, they wouldn't have taken these cases, because these cases really kind of follow the law in Fisher. And so I am not optimistic. In terms of what we can do, I second what Victor said about asking our law schools where we went and graduated from, where we teach, ask them about what they're going to do in response to the decisions as they come down, what kind of resources are they going to give to make sure that they can still, you know, they can look at every applicant and determine the best ways to get diverse classes. But I think for me, it goes even farther back. One of the reasons why we have this challenge with diversity in higher education, with diversities in law school, is the racial inequality and segregation in K-12. And so something that we all will need to do is to turn our attention to challenging the inequalities that are deeply embedded into our elementary education system, to ensuring that all of those kids have access to the kind of opportunities and the kind of resources and the kind of support that make you an attractive candidate at our the nation's top colleges, universities, and law schools.
When you have selective admissions, when you have elite schools with limited number of spots, you have a zero-sum game. You have people who are going to be rejected, and you have conflict around that. And I hope, you know, this is also an opportunity to question just the hierarchy in our educational system generally. You know, who is that serving? Is there a way, you know, because that itself is one of the barriers here. The fact that we have, you know, some universities that are so elite and some that are, you know, in the middle. You know, many places in the world don't have that to the level we do. No one has to the level we do. So I'd like us to question that also and see if there's something we can do about that.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.